Hello and welcome to Wine Blast. I'm Susie Barry and I'm here, as ever, with my husband and fellow master of wine, Peter Richards. What's not so normal is our intro music.
Yeah, no need to adjust your sets. As they used to say in the olden days, I might need to actually adjust my voice, which is seriously hoarse.
A little bit gravelly
bit
today.
Bit chesty. I do apologise. It's absolutely fine. I will get there. But anyway, that is the unmistakable lament of the bagpipes. But no, there has been no wine revolution just yet in Scotland or Ireland. I recorded these pipes on the ancient streets of Santiago de Compostela in Galicia while visiting the magical, mysterious, munificent world of Rías Baixas.
So we're both very excited because this episode is the first in a cracking two-parter on Rías Baixas, an intriguing wine region in the northwest of Spain, which isn't perhaps as well known as it deserves, having been pretty remote and poor and overlooked for much of its recent history. But since the 1980s, it's undergone a strikingly successful metamorphosis, particularly on the wine front, most notably with the Albariño grape and its signature style of invigorating, refreshing white.
Galicia is a land rich in history and myth. It used to be perhaps best known for the famous Camino de Santiago pilgrimage, whose ultimate destination is Santiago de Compostela. But it was also renowned for its brave seafarers on the Costa da Morte, or Coast of Death. It's quite an evocative name, isn't it? I'm not sure I'd fish there. It was also known for its sort of sullen skies, its brooding atmosphere, and even for its terrifying witches. So we're going to be coming back to that. Nowadays, though, one of its main USPs, of course, is its wine, having grown its vineyard from a tiny 237 hectares in 1987 to 4,480 hectares today.
So we wanted to embark on a proper podcast adventure to find out what's really going on in Rías Baixas. Here's a brief taster of what's coming up.
Rías Baixas is a magic place if you compare with other regions in Europe or in other parts of the world. I think it's a special place.
All that complexity that we have in the land is in the bottle too.
If we can preserve these old vineyards, we have a future.
Winemakers Isabel Salgado of Fiaboa, Luisa Freire of Santiago Ruiz, and Lucia Barbosa of Gallegas there. Now we'll be hearing more from them, as well as many other fascinating people, helping tell us the story of Rías Baixas and its wines over the course of these two episodes. We'll also be tasting and recommending some amazing wines as we go.
Yeah, we should say thank you at this stage to the DO Rías Baixas for sponsoring this mini-series and enabling us to spend proper time focusing on this fascinating region. As ever, sponsorship ensures airtime, but by no means uncritical appraisal. So we will be speaking our mind as usual. And there's a lot of stuff to get stuck into, isn't there?
There is indeed. So let's get started. So the plan is to set the scene in this episode, get a feel for the place, meet some of our key personalities, sample the food.
Yeah, there's definitely some comedy to come on the food front. I can promise you that.
And of course, we're going to get stuck into the wine, something we'll explore in more depth in part two, where we're going to focus particularly on the whites and the emblematic local grape, as we've said, Albariño.
Yeah, now we should add that we've both been lucky enough to get to know this region, haven't we?
Yeah.
Beyond tasting a lot over the years, which we've done, you covered Rías Baixas in your book, Discovering Wine Country Northern Spain, didn't you?
A little while ago, spent a decent time there.
And I've visited a couple of times as well, most recently in April, to research this podcast miniseries.
Selfless dedication, isn't it, as ever. And you came back with lots of little sound effects, didn't you?
Little sound effects? What? Hang on, me playing around with my little toys, with my little friends. Is that where we're going with this?
I think you did.
Absolutely, I come bearing sounds. I'd be disappointed if I didn't. Anyway, how about, I've got a few to test out on you. How about a bit of rain? Or a bit of wild coastal wind? bit woolly, that one. Or finally, this one, recorded at the water feature at Pazo de Señorens.
I think I prefer the last one. A bit more gentle and relaxing. I think wind and rain just makes me feel a bit stressed.
They really do. I think they bring you in the rash, don't they?
They do.
You're allergic
to it.
I know, it does. It makes you feel cold. Anyway, thank you for indulging my little sound effects.
Your little sound
they make
effects.
Me happy, so thank you. I think the point I'm trying to make in an effort to sort of set the scene is that Rías Baixas is, in one respect, a land of water. The appellation of Rías Baixas is dotted around various parts of coastal Galician territory in northwest Spain. So it's not one contiguous whole, if you see what I mean. It's not all stuck together. But arguably, what unites it is water, principally in the form of the Atlantic Ocean, which has a significant influence on the climate, often bringing wind and rain and fog and cloud. Just as importantly, though, it moderates the climate. So it's not nearly as harsh or as hot as inland or southern Spain.
You're right. I mean, it does seem to rain quite a lot in Rías Baixas, doesn't it?
It really does.
I mean, even the name Rías Baixas, it sort of almost sounds like running water, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's very
You know, and following the same theme, you know, you've got the many rivers in the region, including the major Minho River, which forms the border with Portugal in the south of the region, and of course the Rías themselves, you know, which are like a series of narrow inlets that run up the Atlantic coast, giving the coast a sort of kind of serrated appearance on the map. And in the Rías, you get these big tides mixing fresh river water with salty seawater, creating this amazing environment, which is very rich in nutrients for shellfish and other marine life.
Which is why fishing and seafood has historically been such a big industry in the area. Yeah. So the water helps provide food and work and also wine, of course, because one of the main things you notice when you travel around Rías Baixas and Galicia, isn't it, is this absolute profusion of green growth everywhere
it's
you look.
Very verdant.
It's like the day of the Triffids, isn't it? You see, the plants are taking over. It's a landscape overflowing with small holdings that just teem with life, you know, mainly vines running riot over pergolas. It's sort of Alberino anarchy, if you know what I mean. But also you get things like goats and chickens and vegetables, sweet corn, cabbages, olive trees, lemon trees, palm trees.
And it's that actually tells you something else about Rías Baixas. I mean, yes, it can be rainy and cloudy and well watered, but it can also get pretty warm and sunny. You know, I think it has an annual average of over 2,000 hours of sunshine, which, you know, certainly isn't to be sniffed at.
It's not
or
bad.
Sniffed over or making you sniff. And I think climate change is actually making things ever warmer too. So it's a mistake to think this is cold climate viticulture. You can ripen lemons and oranges and olives here. You know, one winemaker described the local conditions as, and I quote, a Mediterranean climate with high pluviometry, which is my new favourite word.
Pluviometry.
I had to go and look it up. But
it almost makes rain sound nice, doesn't it? Sound proper. Anyway, that is quite funny. But, you know, actually, when I was there, people were talking about irrigation, which gives you an idea of, you know, it can be rainy, but actually they at certain times when it's hot, they need water.
Yeah.
And some vines had even died from water stress, particularly those on the sort of very sandy, granitic soils, very
that
poor
is surprising,
soils.
So yeah.
That's interesting to bear in mind, isn't it? So it kind of puts things into perspective. Equally, while we're not talking cold climate viticulture, we are talking relatively cool climate viticulture, particularly compared to other wine regions in Spain, I suppose.
Yeah.
And that's reflected in the fresh styles of the wines.
Absolutely. You know, this is a land of fundamentally refreshing wines.
Yeah.
You know, the kind of thing that's increasingly popular these days, which is music to our ears.
Hallelujah.
Isn't it?
Totally. We are all about drinkability and refreshment value. And you can almost see that in the landscape there, you know, everything seems vivid. It's a really atmospheric place with its brooding, damp, sort of fertile feel, sort of dramatic hillsides and rugged coastline. You feel very sort of close to nature there. You know, it's a proper land of mists and mellow fruitfulness, as the poet might have said.
Get you. Clearly it inspires poetry as well. mind you, given one of the region's biggest producers, funnily enough, is Martin Kodaks and is named after a medieval poet and composer.
Well, there you go.
You know, maybe you are
Everyone's
indeed on the money.
Acted out
yeah,
there.
Yeah. And talking of the people and history, though, that's also a subject we should touch on, isn't
absolutely,
it?
Absolutely, absolutely. So I asked a lot about this while I was out there, you know, how people would define or describe the Galician character. And generally, the consensus was that the Galicians are by nature somewhat reserved. Maybe it's that cool, rainy climate, a bit like, you know, us in England, especially initially. But once you get to know them, once they open up, they're friends for life. So it's a sort of picture of people who are generally very loyal, very resilient, very determined, extremely diligent. Here's what Stephanie Schilling of Santiago Ruiz had to say. She's got a valuable perspective as an outsider, originally from Chile, but having lived in Spain for some time.
The people are really, really, really hardworking, nice. When you get to know them, they're like super friendly and all that. It's complicated to get to know them, but then when you are their friends, they invite you always to their homes and are really friendly and very, very honest and transparent. And then they're very generous and they're very rewarding, and then they're very straightforward. Sometimes they don't want to say all what they want to say, but then if they trust you, they do. Look at where they live. I mean, with all the kind of weather. And I mean, if you go out there to the sea and have to get the fish and all that, of course you're going to be proud that you got the super fish out of the nasty weather. And then you grow really good wine.
Intriguing. You know, complex people do tend to be the most interesting, don't you think?
Yeah, and probably make the best wines. Discuss.
Ooh,
what do you think?
There's a hypothesis to test out.
Yeah, no, I also touched on this issue with Romina Lopez, a cultural guide with whom I visited the famous Santiago de Compostela Cathedral. And for those who haven't been, this is architectural shock and awe. The facade of this cathedral is just epic. There is no other word for it. It's massive and so ornate and imposing.
And I guess that you know, part of the point is that this is the culmination, the ultimate destination of the famous Camino de Santiago pilgrimage where the shrine of the Apostle St. James is housed.
Yeah,
you know? And
yeah.
Since medieval times, people have made this pilgrimage over huge distances. Mm, you know, so when they reach the end, they do expect a pretty big payoff, and it doesn't disappoint.
It certainly doesn't, at least on the outside. Inside, I found it intriguing because, yes, you do get this remarkably ornate and baroque centrepiece where the holy relics are enshrined, as you said, but then the rest of the interior is actually quite pared back and restrained and sort of Romanesque in style. It's certainly not as lavish or opulent as I was expecting.
Maybe you were focusing too much on the money or investment brought in by all the pilgrims over the years. So expected a bit more bling.
I was expecting more bling for the buck.
But this was big business, particularly in the day, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's a good point. And it still is. You know, hundreds of thousands of pilgrims come every year. I mean, not all religious, but they come. And just as importantly for Galicia, it in the past, it didn't just bring in foreign investment in the local economy. It also brought knowledge. And it's assumed, you know, religious people tending to be partial to wine, of course, fantastic. A fair bit of wine knowledge came with that pilgrimage too. So, you know, you could see it as the religious pilgrimages helping pave the way for our wine pilgrimages to the region today. Does that work?
I think it does.
It's an interesting notion.
Why not? Why not? But what did Romina have to say?
Yeah, so sorry. We sat down in the cathedral for a very brief chat, and I asked her to describe Galician people.
We are people very proud of our history, very proud of our region, of our landscape, of our lifestyle.
Now, we're sitting in the magnificent Santiago de Compostela Cathedral, and so many people throughout history came on a very long, very famous pilgrimage to this place. How important is the pilgrimage to this part of the world?
It has been incredibly important because pilgrims made us the people we are. So our identity is totally linked to this pilgrimage. No, so religion, being Christian, all the cultural aspects related to the way brought by pilgrims over centuries.
And Galicia for a long time was quite a remote part of Europe. It was hard to get to. It was cut off by mountains. How important was the pilgrimage in terms of bringing people here, bringing their knowledge here, and that sort of, and their money as well, I suppose?
I think that thanks to pilgrims, the north of Spain, not only Galicia, is as it is. So otherwise, this region that was very autonomous, independent, but also not well communicated with the rest of Spain and Europe, would be very different, no? So in our current character and personality, this is pilgrims. What pilgrims brought is incredibly important.
And we're looking at this cathedral. It's funny because you look one way and it's very pared back and actually quite elegant and simple. And then you look the other way and there's this amazing ornate Baroque sort of element to the cathedral. And you said this sort of sums up the Galician character. Can you just tell me about that?
Well, that's very personal, is my opinion. So I think we can be both. We can be very simple, but in a positive way. We can be austere. We can be elegant, like Romanesque. But sometimes we can be very overwhelming in many senses, like the Baroque.
Now, it seems almost sacrilege to bring this up, sitting in a cathedral, but Galicia has a reputation for magic, for witchcraft, and this sort of wonderful sort of alternative reality. Can you just explain a little bit about why that is?
Well, in my opinion, there were many mysteries about Galicia because due to the lack of connection, and probably this area became a little unknown for the rest of Spain and Europe, and that caused sometimes confusions, and this happened with the witches. So they were actually healers. Healers were not only in Galicia but in all Europe.
So it was a sort of a case of a mistaken identity, or maybe just people filling in the gaps with their imagination about a region that wasn't very well known and misunderstanding things.
It is nice to think that Galicia is a land full of witches because it's foggy, hilly, the Atlantic Ocean, and well, probably all this helps to create the myth of the Galician witches.
You can see that happening, can't you? You know, you get this remote region that's misty and mysterious and people start making up myths.
Yeah, and the other element that's key here, which is really intriguing about this part of the world, I'm sure you agree, is the importance and prominence of women in society. And this is particularly noticeable in winemaking circles. You know, on my trip, for example, I didn't meet one male winemaker.
Really?
Yeah. Now, I know, you know,
that is quite unusual.
It's a small sample, but still, you know, it is also something that's generally remarked upon.
Yeah, I mean, it's always hard to generalise about these things, isn't it?
Yeah,
but I understood was that historically, the men in coastal Galicia would be out on the boats for long periods. Mm. So the women simply had to take care of everything, including the winemaking. Mm. And this then perhaps extended to when Galicia was in a really bad way in the 20th century and many men emigrated to find better opportunities, often to the Americas.
Yeah, yeah. So I actually asked winemaker Susana Perez of Pazo San Mauro about this. And she had Maria translating for her. And this is what they said when I asked about the prominence of female winemakers in Rías Baixas.
Es curioso, esta pregunta la he escuchado más veces. Sin embargo, yo creo que nosotros no lo percibimos como algo raro. Porque
in Galicia, it's very, very traditional. It's a normal thing. Women are always being responsible for the hard works in this area. Normally, the husband, men of the family, went out to work, but the woman is responsible for the children, for the vineyard, for everything. So it's a traditional way of lifestyle here. It's not something strange for them.
It's a matriarchy here.
Yes,
exactly.
Sadly.
So I'm liking the Rías Baixas wine scene more and more.
Yeah, I'm sure you are. I have to say, though, it did make me smile thinking about this witchcraft mythology, but then being taken round all these funky wineries with their delicious potions being brewed in all kinds of pots and cauldrons and amphora and concrete eggs and granite tanks. And
all the tools of the modern magician winemaker.
Exactly.
Quite funny, isn't it?
Yeah.
So I think we should take a quick break there before we come back to talk about the food and wine. To recap so far, Rías Baixas is a unique wine region on Spain's northwest Atlantic coast, where vines run riot and the people are fiercely proud of their heritage and produce, wine included. So much so that these days, pilgrims aren't just coming for religious or spiritual purposes, they also come for the wine.
I guess you could class me as a wine pilgrim.
I think we definitely do that.
I'm noble and spiritual. I think I fit into that category. I'm definitely more of a
you
wine
like
pilgrim.
Wine.
Tell you what I am. Definitely more of a wine pilgrim than a bagpipe pilgrim.
Yeah.
I have to say. On which note, though, we probably should have added in our cultural context that this region has a strong Celtic heritage, like parts of the UK, which is why the bagpipes are part of local culture and history, just to clear that one up.
I'm glad we have cleared that up. because now we're going to move on to the food and wine. And didn't I read something recently about the benefits of the Atlantic diet?
Exactly,
right?
Exactly. Yeah, so this is really interesting. We'll post a link to this piece on our show notes. But basically, a clinical trial was conducted into the traditional diet in this part of Spain. So, you know, rich in seafood, fruit, vegetables, but also with meat and dairy, potatoes, and of course, a nice bit of wine, we have to add, you know. And this was dubbed the Atlantic diet. And recent analysis of this study found this diet could make it just as healthy as the more famous Mediterranean diet, you know, reducing the risk of type 2 diabetes and heart-related conditions, that kind of thing.
I mean, I guess it's not a big surprise, given we're essentially talking about really fresh produce, often locally sourced and seasonal, prepared and served very simply. You know, you've got lots of variety, lots of seafood, and also a society that's quite convivial, you know, with lots of family meals and sharing of food.
Yeah, and all that is so important, isn't it? I totally agree, fair enough. But the food there, just to stop for a second, the food is so good, isn't it?
It really, really
it's
is.
So
good.
I mean, what would be our favourite dishes
I mean, the seafood generally is just sensational. And like we've said, done so simply. Octopus is the classic, just this big chunk of meaty, succulent octopus with olive oil and paprika.
Pulpo a la gallega.
Which often they sort of serve on potatoes, don't they?
Yeah, but then you've got lovely mussels and clams and oysters and sea urchins. I mean, not to mention all the gorgeous fish, like the monkfish.
Didn't you have a run-in with a sea urchin? Just talking of sea urchins while you were in Rías Baixas.
Why do you have to bring up all the traumatic events? What is it with this line of questioning? It's not very kind. No, you're quite right. I was coming on to that. Essentially, I really wanted to experience the seafood sector while I was out there in the region. And instead of sort of kitting me out in a deep sea diver's suit and chucking me off a boat, which you probably would have done.
I don't know that I would.
I'd shudder to think what you would. Anyway, they took me to one of the region's top shellfish producers and wholesalers, Mariscos Laureano.
And what did you find?
Loads and loads of sea creatures, really. Oysters, clams, mussels, barnacles, sea urchins, as you've said, scallops, crabs, you know, razor clams, cockles. I kind of ran out of English names after a while. But can I just, by way of brief interlude for local colour, can I play you a recording of what these things are, but in galego, the local language?
More little sounds? Bring it on.
Ostras, ameixas, berberichos, navallas, ameixons, mexilón, ostra plana, ostra rizada, cornichas, ameixa fina, ameixa japónica, ameixa babosa, camarón, bogavante, nécora, centolo.
Fernando Ubiña there, who we'll come back to in a second. But it gives you an idea of the bounties of the sea here, doesn't it? It's also lovely, just can I say, to hear galego, you know, testament to the fierce spirit of independence and local identity here. So these shellfish have been collected from the Rías. Many are farmed off floating platforms called bateas. And these shellfish were all in a series of tanks in this massive sort of warehouse, being purified before being shipped off to top restaurants all around Europe.
Please, please tell me that you tucked in. Please.
I did. Slightly.
I am glad to hear it.
Against my better judgment. It was pretty early in the morning and I just brushed my teeth. So there I was, this sort of slightly green around the gills Brit, you know, at the crack of dawn, a bit woolly, surrounded by
Albarino fueled.
There may have been things the night before, but I was surrounded by these sort of grizzled sea dogs and armies of crustaceans. And before I knew it, I was manhandling sea urchins Then tasting their innards Ooh. And eggs after they've been split open with a strong knife.
Oh, I'd have loved to see your face when that happened.
Well, do you know what? Do you know what? You can actually, because I did record it for Instagram. So we're going to put that on Instagram for anyone who's interested. We might try and find some photos for the show notes as well. But anyway, the lengths I go to for this podcast. Now, that particular experience did test my mettle a bit, I'll be honest. But I was brave. You'd be very proud of me. And actually, the flavour was very subtle and delicate and actually quite beautiful. But then I was taste testing the difference between Pacific and flat oysters.
And?
The Pacific ones are more intense and sweeter and finer, for what it's worth. I was inspecting how they use concrete to glue baby oysters to wooden planks to then grow on. When they put them out. I was slobbering up razor clams, squeezed fresh out of their tubes. It was all, I mean, just the most a feast for the senses, but it did make my head spin a bit.
I can just picturing you. I can't help but laugh at the thought of you, Peter Richards, having to do all that with a very polite smile, which I'm sure you did, as ever.
I did.
You know, but also I think for me as a massive, massive shellfish lover, it is making me quite jealous. I mean, I think all that was missing quite clearly was a nice glass of Albarino to wash it down, wasn't it?
Well, it's funny you say that, actually, because as it happened, Laureano and his wife Guadalupe and son Fernando, who we just heard from, have been so successful with the shellfish business that they launched their own wine brand.
Oh.
Yeah, so it makes sense, doesn't it?
Made for shellfish.
Indeed. So I took the chance while I was there to ask Fernando for some specialist advice, and you'd have liked this. I think you know, I could hear you in my ear just saying, ask these questions. So they make three styles of Albarino in Val dos Salnes under the Laureatus label. One is a fresh young style. Another is a bit more complex, having been aged on the lees, or lee, it's called the lias. And the final one, called Dolium, is matured in oak, so the richest and creamiest style. I asked Fernando what shellfish he would choose to match each of these wines. He started with his choice for the fresh young style of wine.
Clams and oysters.
Clams and oysters. Okay, then we come on to the lees aged Albarino. What would you put with that?
With, for example, a good plate is clams or crabs that boiled and in green sauce. And for Laureatus Dolium, for example, is percebes.
Barnacles.
Barnacles.
Is that barnacles?
Yes. Percebes.
So for the oak-aged wine, you're going barnacles.
Yes. Barnacles have a very intense. It's more that meat. That beef. Shellfish and have a strong. Or for example, other thing is for the grill lobsters. For the Dolium is perfect for.
But how are you serving that lobster? With a sauce?
No, for me, the lobster is very easy. It's a good grill, a good olive oil only, and don't need more. No sauce, no, have a lot of sauce, of course, but if the good quality, the Galician lobster is the blue, no, it's different than the, my respects, with Canadian American. That is orange, but the blue here of Galician, the blue lobster is on grill, is fantastic. It's amazing. It's a quality.
I just want to go and eat that now.
I think we should stop this podcast right now. Go and find some lobster, cook it up, and serve it with olive oil and an elegantly oaked, reaspicious Albarino. Could life seriously get any better?
I'm with you. I am with you on that one. But I think it might be polite just to finish up first.
Maybe we should, but
shall
then...
Shall we do that? We can delay our gratification
I love
a bit.
Lobster. Oh,
my word, what a thought.
What a thought.
I mean, just to add, the Laureatus Lias Albarino was a lovely mix of freshness and bready richness. And it worked really well as a palate cleanser after a truckload of oysters that I'd necked.
It is true though that a lot of reaspicious whites, particularly the Albarinos from Val dos Salnes, do have a lovely salty, saline, almost briny hint on the finish, don't they? Which not only makes a nice counterpoint to the other flavours in the wine, and whether that's fresh fruit or bready richness from lees or more toasty creaminess from oak, but it also means they work beautifully with fish and shellfish.
Spot on. You know, it's a marriage made in heaven. One of the all-time classics in the wine and food matching pantheon, isn't it? Riespaichas Albarino with fresh shellfish. Mind you, before we move on from the topic of food, there is one cautionary tale I did just want to drop in.
Go on.
Lampreys. Beware lampreys. Sometimes called lamprey eels. More especially, beware lamprey stew when served by a proud home chef touting it as a special local recipe when it's dark as the night in the pot and with strange things bobbing around in it. Just don't go there.
You didn't.
I did. Oof. I did. Ooh. I thought I still had my polite smile on. And I thought, no, I'm going to be a gracious guest. And boy, did I regret it. Mm. Oh, my. I mean, it tasted like if you boiled leather and decades-old biltong with a kind of whale carcass and strained it through coal and eaten it off warm asphalt with added mange too. Mm. I mean, I struggled my way through it, but I was still tasting it on the plane home. No amount of mouthwash or Albarino could shift it. It really was quite something.
That's hilarious.
There you go.
So we don't just focus on the finer things in life, elegant fine dining in this pod, do we? It's warts and all. But to move on, what did you make of the wines, generally speaking?
Well, I'm not sure Eddie quite stood up to lamprey stew. That's
no,
one conclusion.
No, I can imagine not.
That is a big question, and one I think it will probably take the full two episodes to answer in a good way. There's so much to say. Generally, the quality is impressive, as is, and this is important, the diversity. There's so much more to Rías Baixas than just fresh, quaffing Albarino.
I know we're going to get into that, aren't we, a bit in the next episode, looking at the diversity of Albarino and the whites, both in terms of winemaking, but also terroir, at the different subzones like Salnes, Condado de Tea, and Orozal. But it goes beyond that as well, doesn't it?
Absolutely. There's so many things going on. You know, people aging wines in the ocean, people making orange wine, natural wine, no sulfite wine, all kinds of stuff. There's so much potential. But there were two styles I particularly wanted to flag up in this alternative context, as it were, and they are sparkling and red.
Both of which are pretty tiny categories in the region as things stand.
It's true. But that may change over time. And I think, I don't know, they showcase the potential of the region looking to the future. Take red wine, for example. Historically, red was actually a big part of the region's production, but that was when it was pretty basic plonk and there were often sort of totally unsuitable grape varieties like Alicante Boucher and hybrids in there. Then everyone replanted with things like Albarino, which was good. But it meant some of the old local red varieties sort of faded into obscurity.
And some were on the brink of oblivion, really, weren't they?
Absolutely. And given the warming climate and general global trends towards juicy, fresh, lighter styles of red, some Rías Baixas producers are reviving varieties like Espadeiro, Sousson, Caíño Tinto, Brancelau, Mencia, Castañal and Pedral. There were only 16 producers making red wine in 2010, but there are 45 now. So it's growing. One producer in particular doing this is Señorío de Rubios in Condado de Tea, which works with lots of smaller growers. So I asked Natalia Rodriguez to tell me more.
We are the winery in Rías Baixas that elaborate most quantity of red varieties and work with all varieties that Rías Baixas allow, except the Castañal. But we work with the Sousson, Espadeiro, Caíño, Mencia, Pedral, Brancellao, Loureira Tinta. And in the case, for example, of the Pedral, is a variety that we recuperate in 2011 that is possible disappear. But nowadays, we are increased the quantity that elaborate of Pedral.
So, I mean, I'm sure lots of people wouldn't be familiar with Rías Baixas Red. So can you just give us an introduction? What's the typical flavour profile? What can we expect from a Rías Baixas Red?
Rías Baixas Red are wines, very fruity, red fruit, blueberry, raspberry, or with a touch of acidity and tannins, but are wines with very expressive. It's the influence of the Atlantic Ocean without oak. For example, in our case, we don't use the oak because we prefer when the people taste The wine tastes the particularity of the wine and are wines easy to drink, but with this touch of acidity that sometimes very a surprise for the people, and there are people that accept well and others need more time for adapt to this kind of wines.
So we're talking about fresh, bright, juicy, crunchy reds. You said sometimes they can surprise people. So do you think we're going to see more and more Rías Baixas red? Do you think it's a category that's going to grow?
Yes, I think it's grow. The way is step by step and it's slow if you compare with the whites. But it's a, for example, the winery was founded and the first vintage is 2005. And in the 2005, the quantity of red in Rías Baixas is minimum. Nowadays, it's perhaps 4 or 5% in Rías Baixas, but there are a lot of wineries that decide to work with this kind of grapes, indigenous grape and native grapes, because it's the grapes that better express the particularity of Rías Baixas, the Atlantic Ocean and this climate and this terroir. And for us, it's very important. And it's true, there are people in the international market that look for and search this kind of wines without oak, more fruity, more fresh, more crispy, and I think it's a good idea.
Do you think climate change is having an impact as well?
I think climate change is a problem. For example, in the white varieties, is a big problem because increase the alcohol, change the acidity, and is no good for the white varieties. It's good for the red varieties because the normal alcohol is 11, and in the last years increased to 12. But it's good for the white, the red. But the climate change is no good for the vineyards and for the production, and we need to doing different kind of things and action for avoid the climate change.
You talk about the importance of recuperating, reviving history. Do you think that traditions have got a bit lost in this area?
Nowadays, no. But I think when we founded the winery, it's possible some kind of varieties lost, for example, the Pedral. Pedral is a grape that we recuperated in 2011. And the first time we only elaborate 800 kilos. Nowadays we are in 12,000 kilos, more or less. It's a small quantity, but the process is a process of recuperation. Mm-hmm. But I think if the winery don't exist, it's possible some kind of varieties disappear.
So we'll be coming back to the issue of climate change in part two. But in the meantime, that's intriguing, you know, rescuing Pedral from the verge of extinction. Mm. I mean, I must admit, I haven't tried many Rías Baixas reds.
Yeah, well, neither had I before I went, and I'm not sure many people get the chance to. And it's true to say, you know, there are some, you know, Rías Baixas reds that are pretty mean and green and murky, old school in all the wrong sense of the word. But there are some really good ones now too. You know, I like the Señorío de Rullos Espadeiro, which was sort of full of graphite and meaty and grippy, maybe a bit rustic, but those sort of flavours. I also like the Mencia, which was really juicy and fresh and upbeat, really lovely. I also was really impressed with the reds at Atis, which is a really funky producer in Salinas, making all kinds of wine.
We're going to be looking at them, aren't we, in a bit more detail in the next episode.
Exactly. But, you know, for example, they had a Pedral that was superb. You know, it was all sort of dry flowers and bitter berries, herbal tones. You know, kind of like if you crossed Burgundy with Beaujolais and Loire Cabernet Franc in that mix, sort of a bit like Good Mencia, really, I suppose. And it was only 12% alcohol, you know, again, lighter, gastronomic. So a really good one to rescue. But also then Atis's Caíño Tinto was superb. And their Espadeiro was just heavenly, you know, really juicy, bittersweet, food-friendly, amazing. So these reds really do have potential.
Rías Baixas reds coming to a table near you soon.
There you go.
Now, you mentioned sparkling too.
Yeah, so if you think about Albariño, you know, it's high acid and responds brilliantly to lees aging and bottle aging. both things we're going to come on to in the next episode. Both of those things are what happen with traditional method champagne-style sparkling wine, right?
Mm.
So you can charge good money for fizz. Yeah. This is a style that Albarino can do. You know, so join the dots.
Rhea Spicious producers are starting to move into fizz?
Yeah, exactly. So a few are. For example, Isabel Salgado at Fillabora had just been on a research trip to Champagne when I spoke to her. She'd been touring the growers. And she said she'd be looking to make some traditional method sparkling wine, maybe with a base wine fermented in oak and long lees age, sort of along the grower starter. That sounded really interesting.
And did you try some that you liked when you were out there?
Absolutely, too. So, yeah, at Pazo de Almuña with winemaker Lucia Barbosa from Adegas Galegas, who we heard from at the beginning, this was Albarino aged for 40 months on the lees. And it was lovely, so sort of appley and bready and savoury and fine. Really good potential there. Apparently, they've done experiments starting with 12 months on the lees. 9 months is the minimum for the appellation. But then they worked up and they may end up now trying 60 months next, which I'd really encourage, you know. Anyway, I asked Lucia why she's keen to make sparkling with Albarino in Rías Baixas.
In the world, which is the best wine product that most people want to pay and think, wow, when we make a party, which is the wine that we pick to celebrate? Is champagne, no? So we have here a spectacular grape that is Albarino. So everybody recognize that is a grape that have a lot of potential to age for many years. So why we don't try to do this kind of product with this amazing grape that is from here?
And you're doing this long lees aging, so the sort of traditional method, the champagne method as it were, but you're sort of, as far as I understand, you're giving it more and more age on the lees. Why are you doing that?
So it's like a challenge, no? We can do this in a good way. We are now able to do this because we are doing for several years. And now it's like a challenge. How we can put Albarino in the world-class fine wines in the world, showing like the good wines, white wines, have the world, no?
I suppose Chardonnay, you know, makes great still wines, great oaked wines, great un-oaked wines, and great sparkling wines as well.
Exactly. Is that the idea? It's like a challenge. Chardonnay do that. Now, what is the next big white grape? I don't know. Maybe we can have something to say about it with Albarino, maybe.
So if Chardonnay can do it, anything Chardonnay can do, Albarino can do too.
It's not like that, but we need to try, no?
If you don't try, you don't know.
Mm.
And I agree. You know, it could work really well.
Do you think so? I mean, I think it could be something that's pretty
really
special.
It really could, yeah. Yeah, who knows? Mm-hmm. Let's see.
Okay.
Anyway, we need to wrap up. But just before we do, you've managed to recommend some wines. Mm-hmm. And so now I wanted to recommend a couple we tried at home.
Fair enough. Go for it.
Okay, so first up is actually a wine made by Lucia at Galegas. Mm. And it's the Vegadares Branco de Brancos 2021. Mm-hmm. It's new to the market and it's a blend, mainly Albarino, but with bits of Trashadura, Loureiro, Caíno Blanco. The Albarino was fermented in large wooden foudre. And it's pitch perfect, Rhea Spicious white, isn't it? You smell that.
It's gorgeous.
You know, you've got lovely, fresh, peachy, lemony fruit, and then that yeasty, honeyed complexity. And in your mouth, really layered, a lovely kind of chalky texture, seriously stylish stuff, and age-worthy too. You know, this is actually, it's a bit young, the 2021.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I tried this against the 2020 while I was there with them. Mm. Both were excellent, but you know, these wines, you can just see that they will improve with age in the bottle, and they absolutely do. I love that really discreet touch of oak here, and the lees work as well. It's just beautiful, Rhea Spicious.
It's very elegant, very balanced, isn't it? And then one other to recommend in a slightly, I would say, contrasting style is the Adegas Valmignor Davila M100 2018. Now, this is also a blend, Loureira, Cainho Blanco and Albarino, also aged in large wooden foudre, but then part of the blend is aged in smaller Hungarian and French oak barrels too. And then, of course, you've got bottle age. I mean, I think this is 6 years old now. So you get this really complex, evolved character typical of these wines when they age. But here you've got notes of clotted cream and freshly baked pastries. Yeah. However, it is balanced by that lovely red apple freshness and just a hint, a salty hint, faint salty hint on the finish. It's just lovely.
It's so nice when these wines are given some bottle age, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, no, you know, it really
they
is.
They really come out of themselves. Own. Yeah, they become so much more rounded and complex and intriguing. So, you know, you get the inherent freshness and fruit, but you also get these extra layers of flavour and generous texture. That's something we're going to be coming back to in our next episode, the topic of ageing.
Yeah, lots of ground still to cover. Lots of debate to be had. Lots of wine to be drunk, including an absolute gem from the 2003 vintage. So a venerable Riesbeisches white that is over 20 years old. Yeah. Do not miss it.
Wow.
In the meantime, we need to do a quick recap on this episode. Over to you.
Gracias. So Rías Baixas is a land of mists, myths and mariscos. That's shellfish, but it didn't work with my alliteration, so I'll just get my coat, yeah. The rolling hills and verdant vineyards of Spain's northwest Atlantic coast make for invigorating, food-friendly whites that work beautifully with all kinds of dishes, but particularly the local seafood. The wine scene has been revived to dramatic effect since the 1980s, and now the wines are more diverse than ever, including red, sparkling, and beyond. The future is looking exciting.
Cheers to that. Our thanks to the Dio Riesbeisches for sponsoring this episode. Also to everyone we heard from in this episode, including Stephanie Schilling, Romina Lopez, Susana Perez, Fernanda Ubiña, Natalia Rodriguez, and Lucia Barbosa. Don't miss the next and concluding part in this mini-series. Thanks also to you for listening. Until next time, cheers.